Welcome to In Gad We Trust, a podcast based in and around classic era golden age detective fiction of the 1920s to the 1940s. My name is Jim, I blog at The Invisible Event, and the plan for this podcast is that each episode features me in conversation with fellow bloggers, with authors, with enthusiasts in the genre, to talk about a topic of their choosing. Joining me for this episode is John, who blogs at Countdown John's Christie Journal. John, welcome to In Gad We Trust.
Hi Jim, thank you for having me. So a couple of weeks ago, after you'd announced the start of this series of podcasts, I came back to you and said that I'd be quite interested in talking about some of the Father Brown short stories by G.K. Chesterton, and I proposed my top 10 of those stories as a basis for reading and discussion.
So the 10 stories that you proposed, I put them in the order they were first published. They were The Secret Garden, The Hammer of God, The Sign of the Broken Sword, The Eye of Apollo, The Honour of Israel Gow, The Strange Crime of John Bullnoir. I presume it's Bullnoir because otherwise it's Bowel Noise, and I don't think it's going to be John Bowel Noise. The Oracle of the Dog, The Dagger with Wings, The Miracle of Moon Crescent, and The Blast of the Book.
Yes. I first came across Father Brown around the age of 12, 13, having read through most of the Sherlock Holmes canon. Father Brown, as he is initially described, as a very short man with a face as round and dull as a Norfolk dumpling. He had eyes as empty as the North Sea. He had several brown paper parcels which he was quite incapable of collecting. In a later story, The Absence of Mr. Glass, we're told, there shambled into the room a shapeless little figure which seemed to find its own hat and umbrella as unmanageable as a mass of luggage. He's not someone who looks the part of the great detective, especially when we compare him to the first description of Sherlock Holmes from Chapter 2 of A Study in Scarlet, which says, his very person and appearance were such as to strike the attention of the most casual observer. In height he was rather over 6 feet, and so excessively lean that he seemed to be considerably taller. His eyes were sharp and piercing, save during those intervals of talk to which I have alluded, and his thin hawk-like nose gave his whole expression an air of alertness and decision. His chin, too, had the prominence and squareness which mark the man of determination. So Holmes visibly is a man to be reckoned with, whereas Father Brown certainly is not and could easily be overlooked and often is. And no one expects him to have any knowledge of crime or the darker passions or of sort of life outside of his clerical sphere. Yet he proves all to be wrong on a huge number of occasions.
Hmm. It strikes me that this goes to show just how powerful that image of Holmes is and how much influence that went to have over the genre. Even all these, I mean, we're now, 130-odd years, I think, on from Holmes. Because a vast number of great detectives don't look like great detectives. There is always something about them that leads them to be initially dismissed, right? Poirot has his slightly ridiculous put-on foreign airs. If you go back to following home, someone like Martin Hewitt, the Arthur Morrison stories that were, I think, about the first sort of series detective to come in after Holmes in the Strand. The whole point of Hewitt is that he looks like this very ordinary, very avuncular sort of man. I've read a couple of the Emuska Orsi Old Man in the Corner stories, and he is just this dried up husk of a man. The Thinking Machine and the Jack Futrelle stories, again, is just this really unusual looking fella. Most of these great detectives don't actually look like, in inverted commas, great detectives. They're not very physically prepossessing. And yet, weirdly, we always feel the need to comment on it when a great detective isn't physically prepossessing. Where, in fact, Holmes probably isn't the only one, but is in the minority in being that physically impressive. And I mean, that's just part of I suppose the clarity, or whether it's part of the mythology that sprung up around these stories, that is the physical idiom that we are almost conditioned to expect, isn't it?
I think with Holmes that the illustrations are so much part of the stories that they've become so much identified with them, so much so that when I read a Holmes story in one of the British Library collections, it feels wrong not to have the illustrations with it. They are so much a part of it, and we don't have that so much. Certainly, probably of these early other detective characters, maybe they did at the time, but they obviously haven't lasted, and they haven't been thought of as worth having in kind of reprints.
I know there are illustrations in the Old Man in the Corner books. I don't know whether they were with the stories when they were first serialised, but I know that certainly they are included in the books from fairly early on. The Martin Hewitt stories, actually, I think this is part of why the Hewitt and Holmes duality is sort of stressed so much by people. The Martin Hewitt stories were illustrated by Sidney Paget, the guy who illustrated Holmes from the beginning. But you're right. I think when we think of Holmes, we think of that very austere, very narrow, very sort of tensed, ready physical presence, which I think has to come from those images being so striking.
But I think it's a shame that we don't have those with Father Brown, because some of the settings which are sort of conjured up and some of the people in them, well, I would love to have a kind of corresponding set of illustrations, but that's obviously sadly not to be.
I wonder if that in part is because Chesterton's writing is so much more atmospheric than Holmes's. I mean, this is not a disparagement of Conan Doyle's writing, but we know that he was very functional in his setups, and we know that he was very much about getting the plot started as quickly as possible, which I think is in part why he went on to be so very, very successful. But Chesterton obviously wrote in a much more florid style. Like the Old Man in the Corner stories, the prose is really trimmed back and there's no stylistic adornment to it at all. It's as quick and as simple as possible. And you often get one very evocative illustration for each story, but equally it does paint a very dramatic scene in the midst of It's not exactly dry prose, but it's certainly not. It doesn't speak to your heart.
That's a good point. So, in terms of the development of the short story and of a detective character, all of these detectives seem to be in the Holmes mould. That they are all deductive types, so they all start with an observation and then make inferences from that, and a logical chain of reasoning to come up with a conclusion which is not visible to most of the people around them. And we have Father Brown, whose method is much more on the sort of intuitive side. At some point he does kind of explain his method, but it's not that convincing to me as to what he actually does. But it is this intuitive bit by kind of observing. At the same time, Chesterton actually does give us the clues and is moving towards a fair play scenario. I think that in most of the stories which we're going to look at here, and I think generally, there is enough in them to allow the reader to solve the problem should they wish to do so. I think sometimes maybe motive would be hard to find, and certainly in some of the stories, Father Brown has additional information which enables him to kind of see who is a more likely killer. But we have the evidence that would enable us to see how things were done, and that would probably point us to the killer without having a knowledge of motive.
To a certain extent, I found a few of these Father Brown stories incredibly frustrating, possibly because I just come at these detective stories from that more inductive or deductive, depending on how you want to think about it, perspective. So yeah, there's a chance that we're going to find ourselves at loggerheads about the quality of some of this intuitive reasoning, which I'm quite looking forward to.
Okay, so if we begin with the Secret Garden.
Yes.
So shortly after a dinner party at the house of the detective that Father Brown met during his first adventure, a man enters a walled garden that has no gates and is murdered, and his killer manages to escape. So we have this impossible situation of someone has come in and been murdered, and the murderer has gone out, and there is no way that they could have got out of this garden because it is walled and there are no gates.
I had read this story about four times before in my life prior to rereading it in preparation for this podcast. And I remember starting it going, oh yeah, I remember The Secret Garden, it's this very average, it doesn't really hold together. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I was so impressed with the quality of this, which is unfortunately not an experience that's going to be repeated another nine times. But in this instance, I think that what happens here is incredibly clever. We should probably just clarify, we're probably going to have to go into some spoilers in order to discuss this in any sort of depth. I will put time codes down below in the description of this episode. We're going to work through these stories chronologically, I believe. So if people want to skip ahead because they're worried of having a particular story spoiled for them, I think that's probably the safest thing to do, because it would be nice to be able to talk about this and get into detail for people listening. I say this because, spoilers now for The Secret Garden, I absolutely love the very simple assumption by which the whole thing is led astray, if you like, that when you have a body with its head severed next to a severed head, that the two were at one point joined, and that it is in fact the head that comes from the body, is one of those gorgeous pieces of misdirection. Because it's the sort of assumption that you don't know that you're making. And even I, like I say, this, whatever, this about the fifth time of reading it, watching for that moment, and particularly really seeing it this time for the first time, of just how damn intelligent and how canny that observation is. It's a ridiculously clever piece of misdirection.
And the reveal, which he does, because they have the body lying down with the head which they think belongs to it, and then they have this second head next to it, and the point where he rolls the head away and rolls the new head on, and then realize, oh, actually, this is the man who was there, Julius Brain, and that is there. And when he talks about it, and he says, well, you know, this is the head, and they go, yeah, but heads don't grow on trees. And they're like, yeah, but you've still got to get another head. And the presence of this other head points to only one other person who could possibly have had another head in his possession. And the fact that that is clued on the first page of the story, because he's been delayed because he was dealing with executions, is just brilliant. Because that's just... it's just in the setup. It's just there. It's just part of it, and it's not something that you're going to read specifically. But if you did, then you might see something there. So I love that as just a little clue, which is not one that you're ever going to get, but is there, and it is fair. Okay, so moving on to the Hammer of God, we have a swaggering bully, and he gets struck down by an immense blow to the head, which smashes his skull. And yet this fearsome blow was struck with a small hammer taken from the local blacksmith's forge. So if someone could only wield the small hammer, how could they do so much damage? And if they did have that much power, then why not use a bigger hammer? This is one of the most well-known Father Brown stories. It was used to introduce both the 1970s television series and the 2010s series. I suppose it depends when you first come to these stories. With it being that I was a fairly newish reader and I was young anyway, and that's where perhaps Chesterton has an advantage as being one of the first writers. You get to come up with these things for the first time. Obviously, no one up to that point has, but everyone after that is kind of sometimes reusing ideas and having to show them in a sort of different way. You do have a possible suspect who is the blacksmith. His wife might have been having an affair with this man, but he's got witnesses who will swear to him having been away all night at some kind of meeting. So he is out of the frame. So they then start to look around for other suspects.
I don't know if this is necessarily entirely fair, but there's one particularly clever part of this that actually reminds me of a John Dixon Carr novel. We know that Carr saw Chesterton as a huge influence on his own writing, not just because of the richness of description in his prose, but also he modelled famously his Detective Gideon Fell after G.K. Chesterton. But there's a point where our priest, who... again, we're going through spoilers, turns out to have murdered his brother by dropping this hammer from the top of the church tower, goes into the church leaving his brother outside. And it says, he went up to a pew in the gallery, which brought him under a coloured window which he loved and which always quieted his spirit. A blue window with an angel carrying lilies. There, he began to think less about the half-wit with his livid face and mouth like a fish. He began to think less of his evil brother, pacing like a lean lion in his horrible hunger. He sank deeper and deeper into those cold and sweet colours of silver blossoms and sapphire sky. In this place, half an hour afterwards, he was found by Gibbs, the Fillish cobbler, who had been sent for him in some haste. Now, once we get to the end, we know that that half an hour is rather important, and in that half an hour he has gone up into the tower, dropped the hammer onto his brother, and killed him. But again, the implication, if you're reading over that, is that he has sunk into this almost meditative prayer dream state, and he is simply found in that place half an hour later. There is a, as I say, there is a carnival which does a very similar thing, which nothing fundamentally wrong with that. If you want to be led to that assumption, if you want to be lulled into it, that is the nature of the game that detective fiction is starting to play. I mean, this is 1910, and so we haven't yet got to the point where I'd say the genre is savvy enough to be looking out for this kind of misdirection and this sort of almost lack of declaration. So it's an even more subtle point to be trying to slide past the reader. It's very clever. And again, it's an absolutely majestic story. It's a beautiful story.
And so we then have, he goes out, he finds his brother dead, which he knows. And we have the blacksmith who couldn't do it. And so the vicar looks at, as you mentioned, there is this sort of half-wit village idiot kind of character. And he kind of points to him and goes, ah, a lunatic. He could have this immense strength. People, when they are mad, can have this extra strength. And he tries to pin the blame on him because he knows that he couldn't get hung for it. If he's insane, he isn't going to get punished with death. He might get locked up somewhere. But Father Brown believes that he was trying to do the best that he could, and he wasn't trying to get someone else hanged. And Father Brown believes that there is still a possibility of redemption for this man, which I find interesting in comparison with Poirot, who we know is also a Catholic, perhaps not particularly practicing, but he does go to pray in Taken at the Flood. And yet Poirot, on a number of occasions, allows murderers to commit suicide and to kind of cheat their earthly fate. But obviously, whatever his religious thinking is not in the same sphere as sort of Father Brown's, who kind of sees suicide as ultimate evil and that there's no way back for a murderer from that, but within this life might be able to find redemption and forgiveness. And at this point, Chesterton was not a Catholic himself, but was obviously close to the sort of Catholic Church and maybe had a greater knowledge. I don't know what Christie's knowledge of Catholicism was particularly, or how much thought she put into sort of Poirot's religion.
Like, he was a Catholic priest, wasn't he, I thought? as a Sarah Phelps joke for those of you who are paying attention. But the one thing I would just like to say about it is, I think partly just on account of reading these one after the other, it struck me very much that the problem here is almost the inverse of the problem in The Secret Garden, because in The Secret Garden they have the body with the head chopped off and they immediately go, well, it must obviously be this guy's head, but we don't know who the guy is. And here, when they come down and they examine the body and the head has been smashed in, the first thing they say is, well, I suppose we can actually be sure that it is who we think it is. And they're told, oh, don't be so ridiculous. That's from Wilkie Collins. That's from your nonsense detective stories. You know, I'd recognise that man's thumbs anywhere, or whatever it is he said. I just find that amuses me to notice that effectively he's taken the same principle of the corpse with the destroyed head. I suppose it's more or less Birlstone gambiting it to an extent. That's just the point I'd like to make, because otherwise it'll irritate me.
No, that's fine. So what's next in chronological order?
Sign of the Broken Sword.
Ah, obviously I'm going to say it's a brilliant, because it is in my top 10. Mm. And I haven't ranked them apart from just saying they are in the top 10, but this one would be towards the top of the top 10. So this is a cold case, effectively. Father Brown drags his friend Flambeau around London and then out somewhere into the countryside, stopping at monuments to General St. Clair, all the while telling him the story of what happened just before his death and the riddle of why an English general known for his prudence lost his head and gave battle in vain, and why his opponent, normally so magnanimous in victory, lost his heart and hung him from a tree. I mean, this in terms of atmosphere is sort of brilliant. They start off in a cemetery at the grave of this general who was a sort of hero of empire, and it's dark, it's the end of the day, and they've been following this trail around, and Father Brown is looking for something which he won't disclose, and all the while he is telling this story, and yet there's much more to it than sort of meets the eye. It ends with, you know, him deciding whether he should set the historical record straight or not, and as to what purpose that might serve, whether the truth is always more important. And this story sets up a trope that has then been around for the next 100 years and used by successive generations.
I thought this was okay. Scott Ratner in the Golden Age Detection group on Facebook did say that he thinks this is Chesterton's masterpiece. I think it's all right. It's a tremendously sad story. It's very tragic when you get to the truth of it. I'm not convinced it necessarily holds together all that much. I think this is one of the cases where he has a particular solution that he's working towards and is obviously very keen to kind of paper through the cracks. And the solution is, I mean, it breaks your heart a little bit when you realise the reasons behind it, and particularly why the story is called The Sign of the Broken Sword, and how this broken sword is used to, I suppose, be emblematic of one thing, because in all of these effigies and in all of these monuments to this guy, he's there with his sword with the tip snapped off, and that comes to represent a very different problem, shall we say, or a very different situation once you get to the end of it. So there's that very canny, I presume that's sort of the trope you're talking about, this idea of something being viewed almost from a heroic or a positive light, turning out to actually be a very unheroic or very negative thing, or I suppose vice versa. But on the whole, I love the atmosphere of this, but plot-wise I'm just not sure it holds together.
No, so the trope that I was referring to going into spoiler mode is what comes from the questions Father Brown keeps on asking. Where does a wise man hide a pebble? And the tall man answered, in a low voice, on the beach. The small man nodded, and after a short silence said, where does a wise man hide a leaf? And the other answered, in the forest. And then later on he goes, what if there is no forest? And then he grows a forest. So the puzzle of why the general has decided to fight when he is on extremely bad ground, bogged down at the bottom of a hill, when he is known to be a sort of master tactician, extremely cautious, he wouldn't put his men into sort of jeopardy. So why has he done this? And it comes down to the fact that it's because he has murdered one of his officers, and then in order not to get caught for this murder, goes, well, I shall hide this one corpse amongst a whole battlefield of corpses. And that is why he takes on such a foolish military action. And then ultimately, rather than his opponent hanging him, it is the survivors from the battle who realise the truth, and they execute him. And so the trope that I was getting at is this idea of hiding one murder amongst the series of murders.
Oh, I see. Yes, sorry.
This story got referenced in a book that I've read recently, and so you're immediately going, is this a real serial killer, or is this going on? Are they hiding a murder amongst a series of murders? How is this going to take shape? I think for me, it's the style of the storytelling and this recurrent motif of where do you hide the pebble, where do you hide the leaf, and then how that sort of follows through.
Okay. Eye of Apollo?
Yes, the Eye of Apollo. So here we have a woman falls to her death. It seems unlikely that it would be suicide, but neither of the interested parties who might benefit from her death, either her sister or the leader of a cult that she was a member of, was near her at the time. And yet Father Brown is convinced that this was indeed a murder. And for me, there is something so simple about this, and the reason as to why Father Brown feels from the very beginning that this was murder, and it wasn't an accident, or that it wasn't a suicide. And then also the consequences of what these two possible suspects have done, which lead to a rather surprising conclusion and outcome for both of them, which they wouldn't necessarily have expected.
I mean, you say surprising. I would probably put a less polite word on it. I think this is ridiculous. I think this entire story is ridiculous. It is a lovely example of negative evidence. So the reason that Father Brown is so sure it's a murder is that principle of negative evidence of something which is not there, the dog that doesn't bark in the nighttime being the Holmes example. And I think that principle of negative evidence is very, very well used and very neatly and succinctly explained. I think there are a couple of very nice linguistic clues in the text. And indeed, having read this one before, there was one bit that really stood out to me that I'll just read out now. This religion is a sun-worshipping religion overseen by someone called Kalon the Prophet, who comes out at the same time every day to stand on a balcony outside the building and pray to the sun. And it says, Kalon the Prophet was already erect, with argent garments and uplifted hands, and the sound of his strangely penetrating voice could be heard all the way down the busy street, uttering his solar litany. He was already in the middle of it. His eyes were fixed upon the flaming disc. It is doubtful if he saw anything or anyone on this earth. It is substantially certain that he did not see a stunted, round-faced priest who, in the crowd below, looked up at him with blinking eyes. Possibly I'm just imagining it myself, but this idea of it's possible that he didn't see anything on earth, that obviously ending up being very much the key to the mystery, because the lady who falls down the elevator, the lift shaft, has been blinded, and so is unaware that there is a lift there. Part of me is like, that's some quite clever foreshadowing. I enjoyed that. But so much of the rest of it is complete nonsense. So effectively, he is trying to kill her because she has bequeathed to him in her will, I think it's £500,000. And this is, you know, 1911 money, so God alone knows what that would be worth today. But if you were engaged in some sort of conspiracy to blind a woman to get her to leave you £500,000, would you let a blind woman write her own will for a start? It just seems nonsense to me. Secondly, the idea that she'd be able to write, and I know there's this whole thing that she's this very... Chesterton has this delightfully dated phrase for it. Hang on, what is it? She says, she is described as having a frigid fierceness, and then parenthetically, peculiar to the modern woman. And so this idea of her being this very driven and independent soul, so she doesn't want to talk to anybody about having lost her eyesight or anything like that, fine. But it just falls apart. Like I say, the principle of negative evidence is gorgeous. But I think as a scheme, if I was going to kill someone to get £500,000 from them, this is... I 30th or 40th on the list of things that I would try.
Yes, I suppose he's not seen the will. He just knows that it is supposed to have been written because he's told her to do it. She said, "Oh, I'm going to do it," and so he then takes the lift up so that she'll just fall down the shaft. But in terms of a neat way of killing someone, which would be taken as accident. I like that a lot.
I don't know. Like, I think if you get John Thorndike on that, he would notice that there was scarring on her retinas or something like this. It's not a foolproof murder. How has she gone about her life being blind without anybody feeling the need to comment on it? I mean, the implication is that her sister knows she is blind and has allowed her to write this will with a pen where the ink has run out, which I think is that's a genius idea. I absolutely love that. But I'm overthinking it, and this is me coming at it from my wanting to solve the challenge to the reader every single time. But I just think practically there's too much wrong with it. It's a hideously long way around when you could probably push someone down an empty lift shaft much more easily.
I think that's fair, and I think that that's where you have a difference between a short story and a novel, is that you can do things that are acceptable within within a short story because someone is only going to be giving 10, 15 minutes of their time to it. In a short story, if you don't like it or you don't believe it, you can just go, well, I'll just turn to the next one, thank you. I love this just for the fact that you have the small crime completely negating the benefits of the large crime. Even if Kalon had not been found guilty or no one knew what he had done, he would still not have benefited from that at all.
See, I'm fascinated by that, because the fact that she didn't know there was no ink in the pen, this is not me faulting Chesterton, this is just what my brain does. Part of me goes, legally, I wonder if the fact that she has made the marks with the pen, which we're assured she is able to do, what does it say, by habit and her strong will and her memory, she could still write almost as well as if she saw, but she could not tell when her pen needed dipping. I mean, dipping is not even a pen with a cartridge in it. But I wonder if technically somebody might be able to say, well, she did actually write that. The fact there was no ink in it doesn't mean that it's not written, because assuming her writing is as legible as they claim. This is just me wanting to sit in a 1911 courtroom and watch people argue this out from a... It's just one of those fascinating things we'll never know. But I know what you mean. As I've said, I particularly enjoy that principle of the sister knowing that she's being conned and deliberately, you know, not refilling the pen so that it's effectively, one hopes, unless she has Perry Mason for a lawyer, it's just going to be a complete washout. Yeah, I'm with you. I really enjoy that.
And then the story ends just with the negative evidence which you referred to earlier, where the murderer is prepared for what is about to happen, for what is about to discover, and can't react naturally to that, and someone spots something about that later and is like, but they knew that was going to happen. And then the counter to that, which you get rarely, is where a killer often is expecting a body to be found inside a trunk or something, because they put it there, and the trunk's opened, and they're genuinely surprised, because they're like, where the heck did that go? They were in there, know that, and for whatever other reason, someone else has been monkeying about with it. And so you get them genuinely being surprised, which actually takes the heat off them, because everyone's like, no, they were surprised. They didn't know what was sort of going on, because they'd been surprised by the wrong thing.
So there's become this unofficial tradition in these podcasts that we have to talk about the films of Alfred Hitchcock at some point. Okay. So this is a slightly tangential reference to the films of Alfred Hitchcock. There's a very good World War II thriller called Lifeboat, which is about these people marooned in a lifeboat and someone keeps killing them. So one of the people in the lifeboat is a killer. In the 80s or early 90s, probably the early 90s, the actor Ron Silver, who probably best known these days for being the bad guy in the Jean-Claude Van Damme movie Time Cop, directed a remake of Lifeboat and set it in space. Same principle, there are all these people who are on this ship and they end up dying one by one. Someone is sabotaging them to kill them. The revelation of who the killer of that is plays into that principle of, I mean, really nicely. It's not fair play at all, but when you see it, it's really good. Plays into that thing of, well, there's no way you could have known that, and so your reaction is inappropriate, or you obviously knew that was going to happen, and so your reaction is inappropriate. And it's an excellent point you make, because I had entirely forgotten this film until just now. I remember that had a very strong effect on me when I watched it, probably as about a 12, 13-year-old. I remember thinking, oh my God, that's a really, really good way of showing that. And that was long before I'd heard of or read any of these stories. And it also gives me a chance to fulfill the unofficial In Gad We Trust Hitchcock reference. So, next up is The Honour of Israel Gow from 1911. Now, this was an extra one that John suggested to me rather than one of his 10 favourites. So I've actually missed out the insoluble problem. We just realised that I'm horribly at fault for this. The Lord of a Castle has died, and Flambeau and Father Brown visit the castle and discover that the interior of the castle is in a certain amount of disarray. Instead of there being snuff contained in boxes, there are piles of snuff on the mantelpieces above the fireplaces. Instead of there being candles standing in candlesticks, there are just loose candles scattered around and propped around for the lighting of the interior of the castle. There's a lovely couple of moments in this where it's suggested that there's absolutely no way that these bizarre aspects of how things are discovered inside the castle can be discovered, and Father Brown kind of rolls through three or four different explanations, which is quite, it's actually pretty neatly done, to be honest. And then gradually what we come to realise, and they realise this an incredibly long way around, and I love the principle behind this, and I really, you're absolutely right, John, I really love the Carian tone behind this. But the thing that gets me is that it doesn't occur to anybody to actually speak to Israel Gao, who has been in the service of this guy for however long before he died. No one thinks to ask him what happened. And towards the end, we discover that Father Brown has actually, you know, taken the time to talk to Gao, to address Gao. He says, "Oh, tut, tut, tut. All that is as plain as a pikestaff. I understood the snuff and the clockwork and so on when I first opened my eyes this morning. And since then, I've had it out with old Gao, the gardener, who is neither so deaf nor so stupid as he pretends." And essentially, he is a very literal man, and he has been left all of the gold in this lord's possession. And so the clockwork is taken out of clocks because the clocks themselves, the body of the clock is made of gold. The candles have been taken out of candlesticks because the candlesticks are gold. The snuff has been tipped out of the snuff box because the snuff box is gold, and so on and so forth. And it is Gao taking exactly what he has been promised, and not an ounce more and not an ounce less. There's quite a nice bit of GAD sort of trope exploration when this idea that it's discussed that actually when they get to the castle, because it's this horribly isolated castle and it's just this one guy living with his servant, it could actually be that the person they're encountering as the servant might be the master, and there could be an element of identity shenanigans going on. So I feel what you're starting to get is this increased meta-awareness of the detective fiction genre as it's starting to build up around Chesterton in the wake of Doyle, with what Arthur Morrison was doing, with what Ortsey was doing, with, I suppose, the Raffles stories, although they're slightly different. There's, again, this lovely awareness that these principles may have been encountered before in other stories, in Wilkie Collins or in things like that. What I find particularly hilarious about this, and I don't know if this is in part Chesterton's own, you know, nascent religious fervour coming through, because, yeah, he didn't convert to Catholicism until the early 20s, and so we're, you know, 10 years away from that. But at the same time, I very much doubt that he woke up one morning and just decided that he wanted to be a Roman Catholic. You know, that he spent 12, 13 years writing stories about a Roman Catholic priest prior to converting to Catholicism, I would say indicates something. And that he wrote the story about a Roman Catholic priest in which every time someone is mentioned by their religion, they usually turn out to be the guilty party, so long as they're not a Roman Catholic. You know, there's obviously this sympathy, shall we say, towards the religious cause. There's a great bit in this. After Brown has offered these various explanations, where he says, "I don't think that it's the true explanation, but you said that nobody could connect the four things. The true tale, of course, is something much more humdrum." Over the course of the next two pages, it's discovered that the name of God has been cut out of a couple of tapestries. And then suddenly, what we get is probably the fastest about-face in detective fiction history. Because, "What do you mean?" demanded the London officer after Brown gets uptight about this discovery. "I mean," answered the little priest, and his voice seemed to rise slightly in the roar of the gale, "I mean that the great devil of the universe may be sitting on the top tower of this castle at the moment, as big as 100 elephants, and roaring like the apocalypse. There is black magic somewhere at the bottom of this." And there's an element of, well, a minute ago when it didn't concern fine, the defacement of a religious tapestry, it wasn't a big deal, it was something entirely humdrum. And then suddenly, because the name of God has been cut out of tapestries, I think this religious leaning of Chesterton's really starts to come through, which just suddenly, you know, it's all the devils of the apocalypse must suddenly be at the heart of it. It strikes me as a very strange overreaction, given how much he was intent to prove that there was something actually quite normal and quite natural. And I think this is something which starts to come out more and more in the stories from this point on. There's one story in particular that we're going to get to that I know a lot of people consider to be a masterpiece, which for me is ruined by how much mythology, I suppose, is tried to be piled upon it. And actually, it's made far more, I don't know whether complex is the right word, but it's certainly made into a far bigger deal than is necessary. If it was kept sort of small, I personally think the story that we're coming to would actually be a much better story. However, I quite like the principle of this guy taking exactly what he's owed. But yeah, it's maybe a 60% successful story. And you're absolutely right. It does have those lovely, very sinister Carian overtones to the vast majority of what goes on.
And I think this story also has, there are links into other stories where you have the use of legend. And so there are historical stories, some of them to believe, some of them not to be believed. And it is finding the key element of truth within the stories that enables Father Brown to make certain conclusions, because he isn't going to believe all of it, but I guess within any legend there is normally a kernel of truth. So something has actually happened which has inspired that, which has then got built upon and sometimes turned into something completely different, but there is a root of something there in the first place.
Number six, then, is The Strange Crime of John Bull Noir.
And this is certainly a strange crime, as we find out in the end. And yet it's one that any reader of gad fiction would be certainly sympathetic to. But we are probably unable to actually accomplish it in the way that John Bull Noir does. But it only becomes apparent very, very late on as to what that is. He's a man who has an extremely attractive wife. She's been spending a lot of time with another man who is extremely rich, extremely fashionable, and Bull Noir himself is a kind of scholar, a more reticent man. And then this fashionable gentleman, Sir Claude, is found murdered. And Bull Noir has been out for the evening. He was supposed to be going to this performance, but he hasn't shown up there. And so he is suspect, and so Father Brown digs into that to determine whether or not he is a murderer.
The problem I have with this is that sort of like the nature of the dual narrative to me once again doesn't work. There is no way that John Bull Noir can be made to feel inferior to this guy who he's known for however many years, and this is something which bothers this rich man tremendously. And so he's, after failing to make him envious, after failing to make him feel subservient, the rich guy decides he's gonna kill himself and frame John Bull Noir for the murder. To a certain extent, I think this is why Chesterton's impact on the short story, and I would argue just in Golden Age detective fiction, is quite a lot less than we generally think, is that his plotting, it does not match up to his ideas. Maybe that's me coming at it from a forensically minded plot construction perspective. But part of me also thinks Chesterton just wanted to write a story where somebody choosing to sit inside and read a book enables them to not be accused of murder. John Bull Noir should have gone along the drive at a particular time. This guy stabs himself up by a sundial and then rolls down a hill, and John Bull Noir was going to be the first one. One presumes the plan was for John Bull Noir to be the first one discovered by the body. Forensically, it doesn't work. And again, we know from the Richard Austin Freeman Thorndike stories that there is an advanced understanding of crime scenes, and you know, even at this basic level, like an appreciation of just footprints and fingerprints and all this kind of stuff, that at a very fundamental level as a crime fiction plot, and this is me, I'm sure, missing the point entirely in Chesterton, but it just doesn't work.
It is definitely a slight kind of problem. I mean, I'd forgotten the fact that he was actually reading a detective story.
He is, yeah.
You know, if it was done, you know, so it is almost introducing a kind of slightly meta element into it, that, you know, that Chesterton is writing detective fiction, and like Bull Noir is a fan of this, and I think that as a reader, we can be very sympathetic to that when we're in a reading mood and we are reading and someone interrupts us. It's the worst thing in the world.
Oh yeah, oh god, absolutely, yeah, I know, it's just horrendous. And you're absolutely right, there is, again, there's that meta element. I love the bit where it says, "He differed from most detectives in fact and fiction in a small point. He never pretended not to understand when he understood perfectly well." again, this increased awareness of metafictional elements coming into it. It's very nice. A couple of points that I'd like to raise about this one. Firstly, that there is some gorgeous writing in this. My favourite is probably that the American man who has come to interview John Paul Noir comes from a newspaper called The Sun. And there's a great line where it says, "But many American papers seized on the challenge as a great event, and The Sun threw the shadow of Mr. Boulnois quite gigantically across its pages," which is just a wonderful, wonderful turn of phrase. There's also a part where it says, "Two men are meeting in a tavern." Now, there are two interesting things about this. The first is they have a discussion, and the line of text in the story is, "With that, he spat on the floor. Yet somehow in the very act and instant, one could realise that the man had been brought up as a gentleman." I don't know whether that's satirical or not, but there's something about gentlemen spitting on the floor that seems sort of unusual to me. And then my last point about this is the American gentleman from the Sun newspaper who has come across to interview John Boulnois is described, in my copy at least, as drinking milk and soda. Now, is that milk mixed with soda water?
I don't know.
That's just weird, isn't it? Did Americans... Someone will know. Did Americans drink... Is this a thing? Was this an American thing? Was this a 1911 thing? Milk and soda. What the hell's that? That's just weird, man. I don't like it. That freaks me out.
Well, you have a drink, American cream soda, which is some kind of fizzy concoction. So I don't know whether it's anything to do with that, and it's, I don't know.
I should point out, I'm also lactose intolerant, so you milk drinkers out there, you have all kind of weird things that are entirely alien to me, but just the idea of milk and soda amused me, distracted me. Next up is The Oracle of the Dog. Now, I think The Oracle of the Dog describes, in a way, one of the big issues that I have with Chesterton, and I'm sorry, this might take a little while to kind of pick my way through, but it'll sound slick in the edit. The issue I have with Chesterton's reasoning, and this is part of why I would argue that his influence on the Golden Age and on the development of detective fiction is quite minor. The issue I have with Chesterton's reasoning is that he seems to come at it from not quite the inverse, but from a very opposite direction to how the majority of a lot of Golden Age stuff was written. So we talk about Agatha Christie a lot in Golden Age detection, and the neatness of her character description and the way in which she would give you a certain amount of a type so that you then filled in a series of expectations yourself. And so you would say, well, you know, this is obviously some sort of a bluff, hearty gentleman, and we know bluff, hearty gentlemen aren't particularly in touch with their feelings, so obviously when we hear somebody sobbing in the laundry, we know it's not going to be him because he's one of these bluff, hearty gentlemen. And so you are encouraged to think of, I suppose, an overall archetype, and then inside of that, Christie would say, well, actually, you expected this archetype, but here is a singular exception to that, which enables me to play with your expectations and surprise you. Is that fair? Do you get what I'm saying?
Yep.
Cool. Now, what Chesterton seems to do is, like I says, it's almost an opposite perspective to that, where what he does is he goes, every single person or every single thing of this type behaves in this way, and therefore, when we see this form of behaviour, that is exactly because every single person behaves like that. But the behaviour that he forces upon them is, to my mind, incredibly atypical. There is another story, not one of these, there's another story that relies on a poet having wandered off and got lost in just the sheer ecstasy of composing poetry in his own mind. And I seem to remember it's, you know what poets are like. All poets just wander off and can't be trusted to stand still. There's one where somebody fails to recognise their reflection in a mirror. And it's like, well, everybody who looks at their reflection isn't going to recognise what their reflection looks like. And you go, well, no, it suits your purposes narratively for this to work. What really bothers me with Chesterton is the number of times you come across this inherent falseness in order to force a narrative end. Now, The Oracle of the Dog is a perfect example of this, right? And I would like to explain why. Before we get into the detail of the story, I'd like to explain why. Have you ever walked a dog?
No.
Okay. I'm nearly 40 years old. Over the course of my life, I've taken maybe, I don't know, 20 different dogs for various walks. Inevitably, with a dog, you have a ball, or you have some kind of a throw toy, or you find a stick somewhere along the way. Now, I'll tell you what over 99% of people who have ever walked a dog do when they have a ball, or they have a stick, or they have a throw toy for the dog. Over 99% of people pretend to throw the ball or the stick or the throw toy one way, don't actually throw it that way, and then giggle to themselves like they're some kind of comedic genius because the dog runs off in search of this ball or stick or throw toy that hasn't actually been thrown. What no dog has ever done in that situation is sit down and start howling about it. I'm sorry, I refuse to believe that any dog, after failing to find a stick or whatever that's thrown for it, has just sat down and started howling. They turn around and they go, okay, where is it? Where is it? Where's it gone? Where is it? Come on, have you got it? Where is it? Now, the principle of the Oracle of the Dog relies on this exact thing. And Chesterton goes, well, you know, or Father Brown goes, well, you know, if you throw a stick for a dog and it can't find it, it starts howling. And you, no, it doesn't. It doesn't. And so inherently, however clever the story might be, and I don't think it's that clever, it's built on this fallacy that he tries to force through. Because again, a bit like with Jean Bournoir, he wants to have a story where the behaviour of an animal is in some way an indicator towards the commission of the crime. And I just don't buy it. I didn't like the story the first time I read it, and I still don't. For the people at home who are clutching their hair and wondering why I don't think, you know, The Honour of Israel Gower is a masterpiece. Sorry, guys, I'm a Philistine.
So the Oracle of the Dog, we have an impossible crime. A man has been stabbed alone in his summer house. And then we also have a dog with special powers. So the dog howls at the time that its master is subsequently found to have died, and can then identify the killer, which is a weaker part, definitely, rather than the timing of the master dying, but by it reacting and by barking at a particularly suspicious character. Again, this is in my top whatever. It's in the top, I'd be saying that about some of the other ones, but in the top five, definitely. I think it is brilliant, perhaps because I'm not a dog person and therefore don't know what they should do. I am perfectly willing to believe that dogs are in the way that Chesterton says.
Well, they don't, all right? And I'm not willing to believe that poets behave in the way that Chesterton says either.
In terms of the dog aspect, he does believe in miracles, but he doesn't expect to see them everywhere. And so actually he is more prepared to look for a rational explanation, yes, of the dog's behaviour, rather than believe that the dog actually is psychic and did know when its master was killed and that is why it howled. And so he is looking for another reason as why did the dog behave like it did, not because it's a psychic dog, but because it is just a dog. And whilst that might not chime with your experience of dogs, I would say that it's possible for a dog to have behaved like that. And certainly it's a more rational explanation than because its master died, and because it is brilliant in terms of how the weapon was disposed of, and the dog is the only one who, if he could talk, would say, well, that's what happened to the weapon.
Now, here's the thing. If we were told that at the time the guy was stabbed, the dog comes running back, smells blood in the air, because dogs have these amazing sense of smell, and recognise that blood has been spilled and was disturbed by that and so howled, I'd be right with that. Actually, I'd be totally fine with that. I would find that much more believable behaviour on the part of a dog being disturbed by the idea of bloodshed than I would the idea that a stick sinking in some way set to. I just, oh, anyway. Look, we'll agree to disagree. I did love the particularly subtle naming of the character De Villain. Do you think that he will be the villain? I'll leave that one to you. Maybe that might be a red herring. We don't know.
In terms of this being Father Brown in sort of armchair detective mode, and that he's not been there, he's just read what is in the papers and then what this man has come and kind of told him, and the fact that he kind of immediately sees the possibilities of the locked room.
There's an aspect here where I almost see this as a very crucial stage of the development of the detective story, because a lot of the stories prior to this, and take take two examples. Take Holmes and his 140 types of tobacco that he can recognise at a glance or after a slight analysis. Or take the old man in the corner who spends the first half or the first two-thirds of most of the stories recounting the facts of the case, and so obviously has a lot of information at his fingertips. I think here what you see, the one thing I will say for the Oracle of the Dog as a story, is that again there is that meta element of the detective being brought the information, having no additional external knowledge of the situation, no additional external knowledge of, you know, I know particularly that on a Wednesday the winds around that part of the coast blow in this direction at this particular speed or anything like that, and going purely on what they're being told, that mirrors perfectly what detective fiction for the reader was ideally working towards with the notion of fair play. That in something like the John Road Dr. Priestley stories, where you are often required to have a huge amount of scientific knowledge if you want to solve it yourself, that's very much your Sherlock Holmes style of story, where you've got to have that very specialist insight in order to stand a hope of solving it. Whereas what this does is this goes, well, all you're going to know is what you're told. All you're going to know is what you're told and what you're shown. And you're not required to go outside and to do any additional research yourself. And Chesterton even says at one point, you know, you've left the geography of this a little vague. I'd argue he's left the geography a bit too vague because he wants it to be a surprise for the readers. But nevertheless, Father Brown does not go to the scene of the crime and then see what it looks like for himself. And that feels, in the context of a lot of the stuff that was being written at this time, that feels like a very important stage of the fact that if your armchair detective is only being told a particular set of information without looking for external verification, equally the reader should be being told the information and not need any external verification. That meta element came through to me quite strongly this time around.
Yeah. And so the locked room, in terms of the fact that it becomes apparent that it is not at all hermetically sealed, and maybe you do need to know what a summer house is, or as to what it would have been at the time, because I wouldn't have thought about that at the time. But this lovely idea that the old man is sat there in his white coat from the tropics, inside a cane chair, inside this summer house that is made of wood or whatever it is, and the hedge. And that it is not at all sealed.
It's a very nice idea.
And again, in terms of it being a short story, it works in a short story, whereas you couldn't drag that out over the course of a novel, because you would have the detective coming in and going, well, this is not a sealed room at all. Look, there's holes everywhere, literally everywhere. But I think as a kind of idea, it is good. And I do like the hiding of the weapon and how that plays into the dog's behaviour, and we will have to agree to disagree on that and move on to whatever is next.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, what's next then is the dagger with wings.
So Dr. Boyne is a medical officer attached to a local police force. He asks Father Brown to pay a visit to a man who has been deserted by his servants and is now alone in his house and in fear for his life. He is Arnold Aylmer, and the third of three brothers, the elder two having died, he believes murdered by John Strake, a man who had sworn vengeance on them for overturning their father's will and denying him of an inheritance. And so Father Brown goes to visit Aylmer, and there begins to witness a struggle between the forces of good and evil.
I should probably love this one because it's a no footprints problem, but this is the story that I was talking about earlier that, for me, just has way too much ladling on of superstition and superstitious dread and talk of silver magic and all the different magics that are going to be used to kill or attack this dude. Whatever, it ends up becoming verbose in the worst way that Chesterton really can be for me. And it just feels like he has one superb idea, which is the hiding of a dead body by hanging it on a coat hook with a hat over its face and a long flowing robe to cover the feet, which is absolute genius. But then he spends a tremendously long time just going on about stuff that you know isn't going to be relevant. I feel almost as if the religiosity of the earlier stories is much more neatly contained, and here he just feels the need to just talk and talk and talk and talk about magic as a way of throwing dust in your eyes that isn't entirely needed. And I just lost patience with it. I skipped some, I'll be honest, because I just lost patience with it. Possibly, I guess, I need to give a bit more consideration to, you know, the time in which it was written, but also given how much Chesterton had written by this stage in his career, it feels a bit amateurish to me, really.
I think things that you read at a particular age, they stick with you more, and I think are more significant for you. And I think for me, I don't know whether that applies to everyone, is sort of in those teenage years where you start to begin your own reading journey. Up to that point, you know, it's probably been very much dictated by your sort of parents or by teachers. And so this is when you're starting to choose what you want to read yourself. And so the atmosphere of it, and so this building up of this killer who's got possibly magical powers. In some ways, we probably know that he doesn't have magical powers because it's a detective story. But again, I think when you're younger, maybe you don't know that it couldn't be magic.
Yeah, sure. But if you take it in the broader context of the detective fiction idiom in which he's working, I think it's 1924, it was moving beyond this. Plus, we've already had however many Father Brown stories written by this point, right? I would say this continues to exemplify how Chesterton's impact on Golden Age detection was so very limited, because he's almost trying to write inside of a style that is being shown as he's writing this to have been outmoded and to have been lost. It feels as if it belongs to a far earlier and a far more superstitious age. And he takes so long about it. He just rabbits on forever.
I think at the end it does go on a bit, because he then talks to Dr. Boyle, and there's more philosophy of, you know, why he's doing what he does. He could just have killed Father Brown and just walked out. I suppose he's got some, you know, some warped sense of honesty. You know, he was going to kill the three brothers. He's killed the three brothers. He's not sworn to kill anybody else. He's finished his crimes. He isn't actually going to get the inheritance. So what's he going to do next anyway?
Yeah, I cannot disagree with that. The particular form of morality displayed by the killer inside of this is very interesting. It is just a shame that it comes at the end of such a meandering story, really, and that it buries, that's probably the second good idea, so it buries two good ideas and wastes an excellent No Footprints premise. Shall we move on to the Miracle of Moon Crescent?
So a man shouts out a curse and he fires a blank pistol. And this millionaire, Warren Wynne, disappears from his office. And the only entrance was being watched by a number of independent witnesses. The office 100 feet above street level. And he vanishes, and then later is found hanging dead. So that's the rough outline. We have these rational thinking men, and Father Brown comes along later. And so they proclaim that a miracle has happened, and they want Father Brown to act as a signatory to a letter which they are going to write. And it says, "But it was you who said it was a miracle," said Alboyne, staring. "I'm so sorry," said Father Brown. "I'm afraid there's some mistake. I don't think I ever said it was a miracle. All I said was it might happen. What you said was that it couldn't happen, because it would be a miracle if it did. And then it did. And so you said it was a miracle. But I never said a word about miracles or magic, or anything of that sort, from beginning to end." "But I thought you believed in miracles," broke out the secretary. "Yes," answered Father Brown, "I believe in miracles. I believe in man-eating tigers, but I don't see them running about everywhere. If I want any miracles, I know where to get them from." And I like this one because it is solved by Father Brown asking and then answering a very simple question, which is at the heart of many mysteries, namely, everyone's looking at what might have happened, or what somebody might have done, or what the effect of this curse might have been, or what the effect of firing a blank pistol might have been. You know, how can you shoot someone with a blank pistol? How can a blank pistol make someone disappear? How can a curse make someone vanish? And Father Brown says, well, you've been looking at all these things that might have happened or might not have happened, but what would the impact of someone firing a blank gun outside your room be? You look out the window. You know, the key, especially to some Christies, is there's all this window dressing around. But the question is, what actually happened? What's the kernel of what actually happened and the known actual facts rather than all these other extraneous stuff around them? And if you can cut that away, when you only have the bare bones, the solution can be sort of obvious.
Well, yeah, this is it. I have never understood the popularity of this story. It asks the baffling question, how could a man possibly disappear from a room with an open window? I don't get what's supposed to be so good about this one. Sorry, I would love to have something to contribute, but I'm afraid I don't. It's just a nothing story as far as I'm concerned.
That's all right. That's fine. So we must then come on to the blast of the book, which I think is very Marmite story. I think you're either going to love it or you're going to hate it and think it's nonsense. I'm guessing that you might be on the nonsense camp, but I shall hold forth, and then people based on the synopsis can decide whether you're going to be pro or anti this one. So we have a Professor Openshaw, who neither believes nor disbelieves the claims of spiritualism. He is at first sceptical when the Reverend Luke Pringle, recently returned from the Orient, tells him of a book that, after being opened, caused two people to disappear, one into the sea without a splash and the other into the jungle without leaving a trail. He isn't convinced until men start disappearing in London, and he is completely baffled, but ultimately Father Brown is not, and is able to teach him a valuable lesson.
I thought this was a masterpiece. I'm not even being facetious. I loved this. I think it's probably one of the best impossible crime stories I've ever read, and I'm incredibly grateful to you for encouraging me to read it. I think my understanding is that Chesterton gets less good as he goes, that the earlier stories are the better ones and the later stories are the not very good ones. And part of the reason I wanted to read these in chronological order was to get a sense of his development, because obviously he was writing before the accepted start of the Golden Age. And I was interested to see if there was this decline as he went along. But honestly, I thought this was just a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant story.
Excellent, because I was completely expecting you to have the entirely opposite opinion.
Yeah, no, I'm as delighted as you are, don't worry.
It is this setup which is so impossible that you're like, well, how is this going to be resolved? People start opening this book and they disappear.
And there is a bit of me that expects to be disappointed when it is that nature of a solution. When it turns out, spoilers, that some of these disappearances didn't actually really happen, elements of that should be disappointing. But what's so clever about it is it's that almost inside-out nature of how it's using these false impossibilities and the larger point that it's trying to prove. And he uses some really, really clever ideas to allow for sort of some of the more preposterous elements of the story. I still can't quite get over how brilliant so much of this story is.
When I was rereading it, and it gets the point, so the Reverend comes in and he's talking to the professor and he explains about the book, and then he says, oh, well, I just left it outside the room. And I was thinking, what's the reason for him doing that? That's like that makes the solution obvious once you know what the solution is. And then he explains, well, because I knew that if I'd just come in here with the book, you would have immediately opened it and you would have been in danger. And so he made about protecting the guy. And the professor kind of acknowledges that and goes, well, yeah, I would have done that. And I'd just opened the book and would have seen what would have happened. That would obviously have ruined the rest of the story. But he produces a psychological reason. It's with the clerk, who's this dependable guy. He's not going to do anything with it. And then he has opened this book and he has disappeared. Takes him from the realm of, well, this is probably just a story about stuff that's happened in the East. It's probably not true. To, right, this is bang in the middle of London, this is the real world, and now my clerk, who's the most unlikely person to have disappeared. It's just brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. No argument here. It's a great reveal, great bit of reasoning, great story, really lovely one to end on. Actually, I think we've timed that perfectly.
So I think on that triumphant note...
Yes, probably a good idea to quit while we're ahead. Thank you, John. This has been a lot of fun.